Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Joan Dahlketter with Performing Edge Coaching International, and it is March the 13th, 2014. So, yeah, I want to welcome everyone, and today we are going to be talking about recovering from a major event, athletic event, just how to help athletes recover mentally and physically from their events in general. Now that the Olympics are over, a lot of athletes, I was being interviewed by several radio shows and TV talking about that. What do Olympians do after the Olympics? And so it's kind of an interesting topic, but not only Olympians, but I was thinking of professional athletes or athletes at any level when you're training for a big event, championship game or a race, and then or marathon, sort of thing. And then when it's over, you know, what happens afterward? How do we help these athletes through those situations? So, a couple other people join us, too.
Yeah. Hi, Joanne. It's Amy.
Oh, hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, good. Is
it Alex?
Alex.
Yeah.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, great. Yeah.
All right.
Fantastic. So, good to have you join us. And I know, Alex, you sent me a MP3 or audio of visualization you made for your squash athlete. Yeah, so I'll give you some feedback on that if you'd like.
Oh, cool. Oh, great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and so, any of you are welcome to, if you make an MP3 or audio for your athletes, as part of our program here, you can email it to me, and then I can listen and give you feedback, too, about your how it sounds and how you could improve it. There's no right or wrong way of doing these things, which is great, but it's just certain techniques may be able to, I could give you that could help improve it even more, make it even better. So that's great. And also an announcement, I've got a second certification level 2 of the course that I'm just finishing up here. It was going to be started earlier, but I just was taking a little bit longer to get everything all put together for the course. So I'll send out an email to you, this week or early next week about all the details for that if you're interested in taking the level 2 certification. It's just more in-depth techniques for coaching and advanced techniques for coaching and also for building your business and for marketing. So, that would be great. People were asking me about that. When are you going to do a level 2? So now I'm finally putting that together. So that's exciting. And so, let's see, today, we were going to talk about recovering from major events. And then, let's see, Alex, you sent me this MP3 audio, and so it's, I think a learning experience that we can all have with making these. You had a squash athlete, I guess he's a 12-year-old, is that right?
That's right, he's a very young kid, yeah. He plays very, very well.
Yeah. So, overall, I thought your audio was really good and visualization. You put it in the, you can say you, use the word you, you are relaxed, you are feeling good inside, or in this case, you, with your audio, you use the word I, to put it in his, to personalize it for him, that I'm relaxed, I'm closing my eyes, I'm feeling good, and that's fine, too.
Say that again, precise it. What did I say?
I was just saying whether to put it in the first person or the second person, whether to say you are relaxed, you're doing well, or to say I am relaxed, I'm playing well. I'm saying that you could do it either way on one of the audios. And in your case, you said I'm relaxed, I'm doing well, I'm playing squash, I'm feeling very confident. Saying it as though he's saying it to himself. Right, so that was fine. I'm just saying that either way works okay. Some people ask, should you use the word you as though you're talking to the person, or should you use the word I as though they're, talking to themselves? And,
I see.
I'm just saying either way is okay.
Especially
with affirmations and power words, you want to use the word I think. Like, I really like the phrase that you said, I fully trust in my abilities, and I'm super confident in myself. So those are really good phrases, I think. So that was good.
Okay.
Yeah. Did someone else join us?
Pam did.
Oh, hi, Pam. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Good. Great. Yeah, maybe in a moment, Pam, since you're on the line, you could share with us your experience coaching at your snowboarders, if you want, or snowboards. Yeah. Just for a moment, I've just given Alex some feedback about the MP3, an audio that you just sent with visualization for a squash player, 12-year-old squash player. And I think, yeah, overall it's really good. The phrases I think that we all learn from this too is, I'm playing one shot at a time. That's a really good phrase to use.
Okay.
You used, Alex. You know, I'm playing well, I'm relaxed, I'm focused. So overall that was really good. There was one point in the middle where you said, in the third game or something, I see a player get injured, he's bleeding, and I get distracted, and then I recover. Is that what something he told you?
Yeah, yeah. That's when he lost focus.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I guess that would be, one thing that you don't want to get too gruesome,
okay.
You know, about it, or seeing him bleeding. I don't know if that would make him more distracted, but that would be a good example of how you could make one specific visualization where an athlete has a little bit of a distraction in the middle of a game like that, and then you maybe it would be good to give a technique of how to get focused, how to refocus. You know, you could say something like, I get distracted for a moment, but then I breathe it out, or with the next breath, I just breathe out that distraction, and I breathe in more focus, and I get right back into the game. It's just a temporary moment off, and then I'm right back in the game. Or saying, give them some kind of technique right there of being able to move from the distraction right into the focus,
Okay, great.
Yeah, so that you can move and saying it doesn't bother me. I move forward and everything's fine, and I can I realize that I need to move to stay focused on my game, that kind of thing. So so that's good. So when you want to have a time when an athlete gets distracted, just say what the event was briefly, like you did. And then just give a technique to move forward, to refocus. You could say, something like, I move my attention to exactly what I need to do next. Or I'm not letting this, I'm moving forward. It's just a short event, and I'm moving on, kind of thing. No big deal, kind of thing.
Okay.
I can play my best no matter what. So so those are some things. I thought your voice was really good, and you were relaxed, and really good tone and good pacing and all with your MP3. So I think that's good. Have you listened? Have you had your athlete listen to it?
Did I listen to this?
Did your 12-year-old listen to the MP3?
I checked with the father. It hasn't gotten back to me yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it would be good to have him listen to it, and then he could give you feedback too. It's always good when you do your MP3s to give your athlete, let your athlete give you how was that for you? That feedback.
Right.
Sometimes they might say, if you got one technique not quite right, they could say, no, it's like with my right hand or not my left hand or something. They might give you some kind of things that you could do, say better, or if there's a particular term or technique that you use, then they can tell you how to do it even better, and then you could do the next one.
Okay.
With each visualization, you sort of tailor it more to what they want. And you find as you do more of these, like if you do two or three of them for one athlete, and then you can ask them, what do you like or what would you like me to say in the visualization? And they'll give you a request, and that makes it, you can make it even more personalized for them.
Okay.
So
my question is,
yes?
In the visualization, am I capturing or adding enough sensory awareness wording in my audio?
Yeah, that's a good question. Are you capturing enough sensory awareness in your,
yeah,
just repeating your phrase so everybody can hear? In your wording, I think so. But you could do more. You could say, ask your athlete, how does it feel, the racket in your hand, you know, and just kind of, because that's a real sensory kind of thing,
okay,
you know, and talk about the racket feels really solid in my hand, or, you know, and find out if he's right-handed or left-handed. And,
okay.
You could say, you know, with movements that, you know, I feel the push off of my foot as I'm, you know, I quickly respond to where the ball's going, and I move fast.
Okay.
I feel my breathing, you know, and I'm able to recover quickly from each move, each step, and I can go. You know, I keep my eye on the ball, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
And, you know, ask your athlete, too, is he more into visual kinds of senses, looking where things are going? Is he into auditory, is hearing the sound of the ball, or is he into kinesthetic, you know, the feel of the racket and the and moving around the court, and then oftentimes athletes, you know, have all three. You can emphasize the senses that they're most aware of, and then you could also bring in the other senses too. But visual and auditory and kinesthetic are the three most three senses that most athletes use. So you could have that feel for the the racket, the feel for the seat on the ground, and where things, the movement, where things are going, and all of that would be good to add some of that too. You know, based on what he's telling you about what he senses. You know, have him tell you a sample kind of game. You know, where are your eyes going? Ask him what do you see in the room? Where are you focused? And then what are you hearing? You know, just to have him kind of close his eyes for a minute and imagine playing a game. What do you hear? You know, the sound of the ball, the echo of the room, all of that. And, you know, when you make connection from the racket to the ball, what do you notice? Sounds do you hear? What do you feel? What does it feel, you know, ask him, what does it feel like to make that perfect contact with the ball?
Okay.
Yeah. So, okay, great.
Perfect. Great. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Good feedback, yeah. They call it, in a lot of sports, they call it that sweet spot.
That's right.
Like when a baseball player hits the ball perfectly, it's the sweet spot of hitting the ball just right. And same thing with, squash and racquetball and just about any sport.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, great. Okay, well, let's see. We were talking about the Olympics, and I know, Pam, you were, and we want to get into, you know, recovering from your sport, Pam, you were working on, you know, we were talking last time about this new sport. Everybody should be aware of new sports that arise, you know, in the Olympics. There was the slope-style skiing, and, you know, in addition to the half pike and all, and I know, Pam, you were working with—is it snowboarders?
Both, a skier and a snowboarder. A skier that's new event, not in the Olympics yet. He's not, but the slope style, which is the going through rails, and then there's three jumps that they do, tricks and spins, and things off of, and so you have to learn all the names of the tricks that they're doing, which is the it's a rodeo. Tiz is a, actually it's not a reverse, and I can't think now. It's not in front of me, but when they go,
when athlete on the Olympics talked about doing a double alley-oop backside rodeo.
Yeah, the backside rodeo 720, which is you come in backwards, and a rodeo is a sideways flip, and a 720 is the number of degrees that you're turning, and then you land. So part of it is, and I did a visualization for him, and so we just went through his whole routine, and I had to get the name of each of the things that he's going to do. And then I made a visualization for him.
Can you say that again? The rodeo is what again?
A rodeo is a sideways flip, not like you're not going head over heels, but you're going at an angle. Well, it's not quite sideways, but it's at an angle. So it's a angled flip that you're going over. And then a 720 means you're going 2.5 times around, and then you're landing. So he's starting the trick backwards, going backwards, and then he goes 2.5 times, and then he lands forward.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, it's learning, again, the language. And so I went through, and before I did the visualization, each of his tricks. And so then I had him visualize his whole routine done frequently. And then he took that out with him, and he's been on the road now, I think, for 3 weeks. But using the visualization, I've talked to his mom a few times, and then the other thing that we did is affirmations, and it's helped him be more calm. I don't know if it's helped his results, but he feels better about what he's doing. So,
yeah, that's good, because some sports, you know, we've probably as athletes we've done ourselves, like running, you know, I can...
Yeah, you know the lingo, and yeah, this is a whole new...
I'm sure you probably haven't done a backside rodeo.
No, I don't. No, I stay on the snow when I snowboard, but yeah, so I've never done a backside rodeo. But the other thing that was really helpful for me is he has videos of all, you know, practices, so he was showing me those, and so he could tell me the name, and then we could look at what he's doing, and so that really helped me see... And then when I could do the visualization with him, I can visualize it also as he's, you know, as I'm giving him the visualization to do the trick and land up perfectly and where to take off and all those kind of things too. So that
yeah,
helps.
That's great. And it's yeah, seeing those videos is great. Yeah, the athlete has those of himself, and if he and if you don't, just for everyone's information, if you don't have videos of the athletes themselves doing it, you can always go online, you know, probably and look up a backside rodeo, you know, on YouTube, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Put that in slopestyle skiing backside rodeo, and they would show one probably, and then you hear the commentator, you know, in these events. Describing it too, what they're doing, so you get an idea of what it is that they're doing and what the judges are looking for too, right?
Yeah, and we just had, because I'm in Vail, and they just had the U.S. Open here, which is just the snowboarding part of the slope style and the half pipe, and it was on pretty much on TV immediately afterwards. Uh-huh. And they did a great job of telling what the judges were looking for, as well as the tricks and how, you know, where they're hitting their tricks and what their tricks are. And so educationally, it was great. Was done much better than the Olympics was done, as, you know, for a new event and what they should have been describing the Olympics, at least in my mind.
That's interesting. What was so you think it was better at the U.S. Open, more detail or?
Much more detailed, yeah. They just showed, you know, they did graphics of the half pipe, and they did it with the slope style also, but the graphics of showing how big the pipe is, how, you know, the sidewall is 22 feet and they have to go up there, and then how high they're coming out of the pipe and where they're making each of their hits, and then typically what they're, you know, then what they talked about, what the judges are looking for in each of those hits. So it's like the amplitude, how high they're coming up out of the pipe. And then each of the tricks, what how many spins and what the harder tricks are, and they're judging on, you know, the amplitude, the difficulty, and the technical tricks and things like that. So, yeah, they described it very, very, for a person just looking at the sport new, they would know, oh, okay, I get what they're doing, kind of, a little bit anyway. Instead of then when you hear somebody talking a backside rodeo 360 or, you know, 720 or 1280 or whatever, nobody even knows what that is. So
yeah, exactly.
They educated the public a little bit more, so it helps.
Right, yeah. And, yeah, so what issue in terms of the mental aspect of the sport and dealing with various things, have you, what kinds of things have you worked on with your athletes?
Well, his is self-confidence, and so, and it's learning, learning to land a trick. And so part of what we're doing is just believing that he's going to land it, and then he does, because in practice he's landing it either when they practice, they land in pits first and then they go on to the snow, and even on one of their snow jumps they have a pit at the end, so you're not landing on the snow. So it's then the visualization of transitioning from a pit to the snow and seeing yourself landing and flowing and going forward. So that was part of what we were working on with him, is just seeing himself hitting the trick and landing it to continue to the next trick. So that, you know, it's a continuous process. It's not just one trick. So we just talked about the self-confidence of that. And the other part that he was having trouble with is he's learning this new difficult trick, and he has a lot of friends who he goes out with every day who have, are now hitting that trick all the time, so their results are much better, and that's frustrating to him. And so we just have to talk about patience of learning how to hit the trick and then moving on from that too.
Yeah, have you dealt with any athletes who've not landed so well, or and then or not done well, and how to recover from that?
He's crashed a bunch on his not thrown up because he doesn't have the confidence to throw it. So then we talked about, okay, well, what's the worst? I mean, obviously falling is the worst, but and getting hurt, but just, you know, that you have to have the belief to just throw it down and then go from there, too. So that's when he gets back and when we start meeting face-to-face again, that's what I'm going to work on, is, you know, what happens when you biff something and then you still have to go back out and you get two runs or one run, and you have to really put that behind you, the first run, if you didn't score well. Because in the Olympics, like if you saw some of those guys, well, you get two runs or sometimes in three, and if you biff on one, you get another chance to do the same run again and score well and hit all your tricks. So you have to let that first run go.
Yeah, exactly. When it, you know, the mind oftentimes is doing exactly the opposite. You're replaying that mistake over.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any helpful techniques, or have you learned from your athletes what they do to let the last one go?
Part of it is just, you know, wiping it away and using one of the things I've done is just, there's the flush it, flush that one away. But then
toilet.
Just using, you know, just saying to yourself, flush it, like get rid of it, flush it away.
Uh-huh.
But then having touching a body part, so like in a visualization will create some kind of anchor that says, okay, you know, if I want to get rid of something, I'll make a fist, or if I want to, you know, actually that's not a good one, but if I want to get rid of something, I'll shake my hand, and if I really want to hold on to it, if I did something really well, then I would make a fist and really hold on to that feeling, you know, and that becomes an anchor that, okay, if I like what I did, I make the fist. If I don't like what I did, I shake my hand, then it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good, yeah. And then there's the other aspect of, I guess, going from practice to the, you to the real competition, the U.S. Open or the Olympics, you know,
mm-hmm.
how different that is in terms of pressure and expectations and all of that. We saw
with
Sean White, that didn't work well.
One of the things that I talk to when I work with whatever sport it is just having that pre-race, pre-event ritual that you can just go through that puts you in the zone. You know, if you're going through your process of putting your music on, doing your warm-up the same way every time, that just gets you ready for the competition just like it does for the practice. And so that's something I always work on with athletes.
Yeah, right. And just saying this is, just do what I always do.
Exactly, yeah.
Just another performance. Even though it is a really important performance, you have to say to yourself, "This is just, another run here." Just
exactly.
In their case, just another rodeo, right?
yeah.
Or whatever it is that they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess it's different too with a judge sport here. Versus like slopestyle or half pike versus like squash we were just talking about with Alex or running or something where you just go to the first one to the finish line wins. It's not that
clear.
Not as clean cut with this type of judge sport, right?
Right, yeah, and it makes it much different because there's only, and again, there's certain things you can control, and that was my slopestyle athlete, of it being a judge sport, you can't always control how a judge judges it, and if they're a lousy judge, that's out of your control too, and he talked about some experiences where he had judges that weren't fair and makes it difficult.
Yeah, exactly. You want to go up and ring the guys out, or you want?
Yeah.
Or is it several judges that are judging?
It's several judges. Yeah, there's typically like three to five, I think. So yeah, it's more than. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really interesting that you kind of need to become a snowboarder in your own mind, Pam, when you're working with these guys.
yeah. Well, and I do snowboard. I don't do the free skiing. So the techniques of some of that is different. But yeah, you have to. I mean, it helps anyway.
And then when you're skiing, they're doing these same like the slopestyle with skis as opposed to snowboard, right?
Yes, yeah.
With them too, did you say?
But they're, I have, the kid that I am working with is a skier doing the new events that are now in the Olympics. But I don't, and I am a snowboarder, but I know the tricks, and I know the kind of the lingo because I've been doing it for a while, but it's totally a different talk. You have to know the talk.
And you look at them, we all saw them in the Olympics, and you think, God, this is hard enough with a snowboard with just this one thing on your foot, but skis with two things dangling around on your feet.
yeah.
It's even more complex.
and the poles, too.
What's that?
So, and the poles also.
Yeah. You got all this
stuff. Some of the skiers actually have, when they're doing the half pipe, I think the slopestyle too, they don't use their poles anymore, so that makes it different too. Much more equipment to get in the way.
Yeah. So more to visualize kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you get to talk or did any of the you said they just had the U.S. Open, and then were these athletes just coming back from some of them coming back from the Olympics, and then
some of them were, yeah. And I didn't go promote myself at all because I had something else on my plate that weekend. But yeah, there was probably about four or five of the athletes that had been at the Olympics, that then they had a little question-answer panel. They were there. And some of them, one of the halfpipe guys, no, several of them didn't even qualify for the finals because they were just probably exhausted from being on the road in the Olympics and everything. But then it gave a couple other people that were at the Olympics that didn't do very well, like one of the halfpipe riders from the U.S. team ended up winning here, and he was very excited to be here because it was a good pipe, much better conditions than they had at the Olympics, and so he could throw down all his tricks, and he did a great run.
He said
he was very, you know, totally looking forward to that, to have another, not another chance, but a chance, and he's from the state of Colorado, too, to be able to do what he did and win here meant a lot to him. So,
yeah, I know some of the athletes we saw on TV, you know, were kind of, I mean, people didn't know anything about the slope style or this sport before. They were unknowns, and then they became household names like Jamie Anderson.
Yeah.
The other guy, that won the men's. You know,
so. Yeah, and Jamie was here, and she won her slopestyle here. So she's the only one that got gold Olympics, and then at the U.S. Open also. The rest of the athletes that were there didn't.
Yeah.
No, actually, Kelly Clark, halfpipe. She got a bronze at the Olympics, and she got gold here. So.
Yeah, that must have been exciting for you to see that.
Yeah.
People coming back from the Olympics that are now.
Yeah.
Famous and all. And next time you might want to try to get a pet press pass or something so you can, you know.
Yeah, I'll work on that next time. I just I had something else going on. So
yeah.
I will for the next one. It's going to be here every year for a while. So, yeah.
Great. Congratulations. That's so exciting, Pam. You're right.
Yeah.
On the forefront of what we just saw on TV.
But you also saw what you were talking about, and you know, talking about as a letdown. Some of those athletes came back hurt or just so tired that they couldn't perform here, and it's the letdown after the Olympics, I'm sure, you know, the whole mental and physical letdown of being ready for that and then coming back and trying to keep going.
Yeah, exactly. So there's always another event and all, and the Olympics is such a huge thing that it's hard
to
know. No matter what, how do you top that afterward, you know, kind of thing. So, okay, well, that's great. Thanks for sharing, Pam. And
you're welcome.
Interesting stuff, yeah. And a different, you know, brand new sport to all of us, the slope style and skiing. And you're really on the forefront of, you know, brand new things there.
Yeah. So it's great. Fun people to work with. So thanks.
Exciting, yeah. Just being able to imagine. It's a lot like gymnastics, you think, you know, with, you know, your body, knowing where your body is in the air.
Yes.
Doing those flips and all and being how the brain needs to work to be able to kind of anchor yourself to always be looking at the ground and all. Yeah, and you probably work with the coaches, or if you hear what the kinds of things that their athletic coaches are telling them.
Yeah,
about technique, and then using those same cues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I did the same thing with Stacy Jagila when I worked with her, who won the first Olympic gold medal in the pole vault. She's up in the air and doing that. You know, it's like a gymnastics move basically, where you're twisting around in the air, only it's just doing pole vault instead of slope style.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So.
Your body's all over in the air, and you have to keep that orientation. So it's interesting. And then I also worked with the last Olympics, for both Torino and then Vancouver Olympics, I worked with Dana Lindsay, who was at the time the number one ranked aerial skier in the U.S., and
mm-hmm.
wanted to do the triple flips in the air. And they, and she had, you have to really keep your orientation in the air as well. And they're doing all, you know, going way up high in the air and coming down. And for the Olympic trials, she went up in the air, and then it was at nighttime, and the conditions weren't real good, and she lost her orientation and came down and crashed and hit her head and landed right on her head and got a concussion. was really scary. And that was in the Olympic trials, and then went, you know, had to be hauled off to the hospital. And but then she found out she was recovering okay, luckily, and then she found out she made the Olympic team anyway. That was the Olympic trials, and then, you know, she obviously didn't win there, but she made the Olympic team anyway based on her points, accumulated points from the World Cup series. That and so she ended up, they said, you can, yeah, you made the Olympic team, you know, get well quickly. And so I, you know, I had to work with her to regain her confidence. And so she ended up being able to do well in the Olympics only 3 weeks after that. So it's a case where, you know, sports psychology and this mental training really comes in. So, yeah, great. Does any, so let's talk about recovering from from your event and all. And does anyone else have anything to share, any success stories or updates? Okay, well, I'll give you some training here, and then we can go to, if anyone else has other questions, you know, feel free to join, you know, jump in. So I just wanted to chat a little bit about, you know, since, yeah, the Olympics just completed, you know, it's interesting, I was getting calls from radio stations and TV saying what happens after the Olympics, what do Olympians do afterward? Is there that emotional letdown, and how long does that last, and what can athletes do? Oh, did someone else join us, or rejoin us, I guess?
Oh, it's me, Dr. Joanne. I just got cut off for some reason. It's Michelle.
Oh, right. Oh, thanks.
Dr.
Right.
Joanne.
Yeah, Michelle.
I don't know if
you're all the way over in Bali, right?
Oh yeah. I don't know if other people are having a hard time hearing you, but your voice is so soft. Is it my computer or?
Oh, okay. Oh, thanks for telling me. Can other people hear me? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's better. Yeah.
Oh, maybe I didn't have the.
That's better.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, let me know if it gets too soft. Maybe my headset was too far from my head. Okay, I'll try to keep this real close here. Is that better for you, Michelle?
Yes, thank you. I can pull the side of my face off my computer screen now.
All right.
It's a bad look.
Oh, thanks. Okay, I'll try to keep this close here. Sorry about that. So, you know, what happens to you mentally after, you know, or athletes after they cross the finish line of their event, or, you know, complete their event, or what happens if they don't quite make it to the finish line after all those months of intense training, you know, regardless of whether or not you meet your goal in your event, there tends to be, I think, an emotional letdown afterward with the physical exhaustion, and, you know, so much time and energy goes into the training and preparation for a major event that is critical to, I think, understand what happens to the mind and body, you know, before and during, after their event. And I think whether it's an endurance event or whether it's, you know, just a long training for, no matter what sport it is, whether you're, you know, golf you know, or tennis, or squash, or any, or, you know, slope style skiing, you know, you're taking your body well beyond its normal output level. And I think during such long events like this, or a long, you know, a series of events, the mind is pushing the body to do an excessive amount of work, and, you know, there's an extreme amount of stress also taking place in the neurochemistry of the brain for those extended periods. And, you know, the brain uses energy just like any other part of our body. So to demand its attention and deliberate functioning for these long periods, I mean, it can also deplete its reserves of, you know, your normal resources. So there's, I think, oftentimes athletes feel this emotional void, you know, after a long demanding event, and, you know, just like the Olympics that we just saw. And I think it's a signal for the body, that body and mind, that the body and mind are both exhausted. And it's a cue that both your mental, not only the physical system, but mental and physical systems need recovery time following the event, you know, in your athletes. So, you know, in my practice, I've noticed that my coaching practice, I noticed that after a major event, athletes, oftentimes they move toward, you know, one or, you know, one extreme. They're either, both that can lead to problems. Some athletes don't take enough time off, you know, like Pam was saying, they got to go right into another event, you know, from, say, the Olympics to the U.S. Open, you know, in snowboarding, or, you know, they've got, you know, same thing with track athletes right after the Olympics. They have to go with, in the summertime, they have to go right on to the European track series, and because that's where all the money is, so they need to be able to, you know, earn a living. And so they return to intense training too soon after their race. So they have all sorts of opportunities. If they did really well, you know, they're getting appearance money or prize money to go somewhere else, and so they need to keep going. And they might experience burnout or injury because they're just, you know, doing one major event after another. And then and some others feel so emotionally and physically drained after their event that their energy really drops off, and they, you know, and so they can go the opposite way and not just, you know, lose all desire to train. They just want to take a long break after their event. And so, you know, either so they're either going to one extreme of more and more competing afterward, or just they continue to train too hard, or else the other way is they're just, you know, just really emotionally and physically drained, and they just become a couch potato for a long time. And sometimes gain weight, sometimes overeat, and others, and or drink, and that sort of thing. And so that sudden change in routine and lack of stress relief can lead to sometimes just feeling a down, emotional letdown, or even depressed symptoms. And I call it you know, sort of that post-event hangover, where. And if it's in the winter time, you know, like with these winter athletes, snowboarders, that kind of thing, you could have, you know, what's known as seasonal affective disorder, which is, you know, also called SAD or winter depression, and brought on by the winter season when, you know, you've got the darker, longer winter months and shorter days. And stormy weather, that kind of thing, can contribute to, you know, just feeling down. And so there's, you know, sometimes athletes have, it really plays havoc with your emotion, with your motivation and your ability to recover from a major event. And that's where I think you and I, as athletes, as coaches, we can come in and really help with that process of helping athletes to recover. But first it's important to notice what the symptoms are, or signs, I think, of an athlete who has that emotional letdown or depressed mood or loss of interest. And so some of the symptoms to look for are, you know, fatigue, like Pam, you were mentioning, in the athletes that are, you know, hurt or injured coming back from the Olympics or other major events. They can have, you know, fatigue or loss of energy, tiredness, or, you know, low energy, no exertion, and, you know, training seems harder than usual. Or you might notice that they have a loss of interest or pleasure in activities that are usually pleasurable, you know, like training. They might have social withdrawal, you know, reduction in sexual interest, and just the things that, you know, they just don't feel like doing as much. They might have depressed mood, like feeling sad or hopeless, especially if they've really trained hard for an event and then didn't get the results that they wanted. Sometimes, or, you know, in the case of the Olympics, you know, it's like the medal is what everyone's going for, you know, first, second, or third. And if you get fourth place, even though it's a really good achievement, a lot of athletes consider that a failure and will, you know, go into a depression or feeling frustrated. And then, you know, just a sense of not caring, down in the dumps for a while. You can also look for other signs to look for in these athletes, or like a change in appetite, where they have, you know, increased food intake or craving of specific foods like sweets or fats. Or they could go the other way and have a reduced desire for food when they're severely depressed, swings in body weight. And then some other signs are sleep disturbance. You know, you have trouble going to sleep or staying asleep or oversleeping, you know, just having trouble desire to get out of bed. I know these are things you're thinking that maybe athletes wouldn't have, but actually they can go, you know, we're all human. And when, you know, after a major event, I've seen it a lot where athletes just kind of go the opposite direction of where they're just not their normal self. They can also, another symptom could be agitation, irritability or restlessness, or inability to sit still, that kind of thing, because they're, maybe if they're injured, you know, they're used to a lot of activity, but now they can't have their normal activity because they're, you know, they've hurt themselves, and so they don't know what to do with all their energy, so they get this agitation or anxiety. Or there can be a sense of worthlessness, is another sign, because they're, you know, their whole identity is tied up in their physical performance, and if they're not, you know, if it's the off season or they're not sure, maybe they're in a transition and they're considering, you know, whether, you know, like if it's an Olympic athlete, they're thinking, guy, four more years, I have to go 4 more years before another Olympics, can I still keep up this level of training for all that time? And wondering if they're going to retire as an athlete or whether they're going to keep going. So those are kinds of things that athletes are considering. They sort of, you know, ruminate over past failings and have a maybe self-blame or exaggerated sense of responsibility. Or maybe they thought that somebody else was, you know, took away their moment to shine, like, you know, with a judge sport like the slopestyle, you know, it was the judges that decided who's going to get the medal, and that maybe the judges weren't completely fair. It's really tough in those kind of sports because there's some things that are out of your control. You know, what the judges think of your performance. Same thing with, I guess, ballet and that kind of thing with Amy, with some of the things that you're doing. And then there's, you know, difficulty concentrating is another sign to look for. Difficulty focusing or trouble making decisions. You know, memory issues or easily distracted. So those are some signs to look for. I didn't want to get you all depressed, but just some things to think about, look for in athletes. And I think if our athletes, you know, participate in events, they'll inevitably experience some of those symptoms that we just talked about. Regardless of what their outcome is of their event in their sport, and the depth and duration of those symptoms depends on, you know, how well the athlete uses their resources and tools for recovery, and also you can help with that process so that it doesn't have to be as deep or as long. I think the key to accelerating recovery and to preventing burnout is to, you know, recognize those possible warning signals early on and then intervene before they become too serious. So, you know, being able to look into the mirror and confront yourself is, I think, you know, that's it's a tough thing to do sometimes. But if you can help the athlete to and educate them to examine these kind of less than productive patterns, then I think you can help the athlete be well on their way to a positive recovery, long-term success in training. So some suggestions I wanted to give you are things like, here's just a few suggestions, then we can talk about you know, how you might apply these to your athletes or any questions that you might have. So here, some tools for recovery and to give your athlete renewed motivation are, the most important one, of course, is to take a break and rest. And athletes have trouble doing that a lot of times because they're used to training so intensely. It's really tough. But it's okay to be, you know, do nothing for a few days after your event, be lazy, allow time for healing mentally and physically. And with athletes, most of the time they need to be doing something to keep from going crazy. So you can suggest that they take what I call active rest by doing a different sport for a few days. Like if you've got a runner that just finished a marathon, then they might want to do swimming which is really gentle on the body and low impact, and it helps you recover quickly. You know, do hiking, rollerblading, cycling, cross-country skiing, something a little different, or playing softball, playing foosball, playing, you know, another game, so that something that's non-competitive, but where they're still moving, and they can still get those endorphins if they're doing something that's aerobic. So you can help your athlete get a tremendous psychological boost and probably not lose any of their fitness level. And then, you know, having a healthy, balanced lifestyle is really important as well. Just being able to, you know, use the athletes have been so focused on their one event for the championship, no matter what sport, whether you're dealing with high school athletes or college or whatever the sport is, if they can, you know, make time for others, for things other than training and competition, you know, they're thinking, other than training, what else could I do? You can, you know, schedule other activities, like do some recreational things, social events, educational pursuits, take a class. Build a broad-based lifestyle with other interests, and then strive for that balance between work and fun and social time and personal quiet time and time to be creative. There's so much you can do online with courses. And often after the, you know, something like the Olympics, athletes, you know, if they do win a medal, you know, they're wondering what to do after that. Oftentimes they want to go to college, and colleges absolutely love Olympians. Whether they want a medal or not, if you've got anything to do with the Olympics, that can really help an athlete to get into the college of their choice and get a scholarship for college. So if you can help them to make that transition to, you know, in between the Olympics to you know, get into a college that they want, it's a great time to use that new credibility that they have as an Olympian or as a professional athlete to be able to get into a good college. And I mean, Sky, you know, colleges are so expensive these days. You know, I used example of one athlete that I helped to coached her, and then she got in on the gymnastics team for the Beijing Olympics, and then and we worked afterwards. She was applying to Stanford, and then she ended up getting a 4-year full ride scholarship to Stanford University based on being in, you know, and that being an Olympian really helped with that. And so that was, I mean, that's worth $250,000 or more, you know, as and just a huge, you know, basically having a college or college paid for because she was a good athlete and an Olympian. So, or even if you're not an Olympian, if you're just doing really well in a sport, there's scout. Like I have one, a college baseball player right now that's in just a local college here, but all the scouts are coming around for all the major Division I universities looking at him and the other athletes' performances. And so if he plays really well, you know, that can lead to a full college scholarship for him. It can lead to a really great job later. So if you can help them with the athlete with other endeavors, you know, to look into their academic pursuits, that can be a really good way to help them move forward in their life in general, as well as that can take their focus off the sport for a little while, allow them to recover quicker. So there's that, and then building a healthy, balanced lifestyle, and then building variety. You know, just put away your ask them to put away the watch for a little while if they're timing themselves or scoring, and just do their sport for fun. You know, just put some new spark in their training. Go to different places to train. If you're a runner, go to different trails and that kind of thing. And have a regular schedule, you know, eat regularly and get a consistent amount of sleep at night and try to reduce workload. So just kind of get into a regular, a different routine of instead of just training all the time, but just, you know, just trying to do those regular things that help with eat and sleep and doing some sort of other activities. And then just to, you know, try to be sensitive to your body as well. Become partners with your body. Regular listening. If an athlete is injured, then they might need to really listen and find out how much they can do each day. And you know, just be able to give your body the time it needs to recover. And that way, you'll know when it's time to push hard and when you need to back off. And then a couple other things are just social network. You know, sometimes athletes tend to isolate because they're only used to being around their other athlete friends. But if you can encourage them to spend more time with family and friends, and some others who are, some who are sports oriented and some with other interests, to be able to have that other social support. Of course, with all the social networks, Facebook, Twitter, it's easier to do that now. And so people can do that. They can also, you can encourage your athletes to take the pressure off and don't try to force physical improvement, but just lighten up on the rigid training schedule for a little while and exercise according to your feelings each day. To not, a lot of athletes have this strict schedule and that you have to do this many miles this day and this many miles each day. And you want to be able to have your athletes just be able to train according to how they feel each day for a little while. And then when the right time comes, you can get back into more strict training. And it just, we really need that break, I think. I mean, Kenyans over in Kenya, they'll take, they're running at a very high level, 100 miles a week, up to 140 miles a week for their marathon training. And then after the marathon, in the off season, they'll take a whole entire month off with no running at all or just walking, to get that full recovery. And then they begin slowly training again. And it really, then they come back with this renewed, they're just on fire after that and have this renewed energy that is amazing. Most athletes don't allow themselves that luxury. So if you can help them to get some of that, to take off time, it's really important. And then be able to just use setbacks as opportunities. If your athlete didn't get the results that they wanted, encourage them to, find it. Let's look at the constructive lessons from what happened, and just be able to move on and look toward new goals and look for the advantages in every situation. And the most important thing is just to, help your athletes when you're coaching them, help them to relax and enjoy life, just for what it is, make a deliberate effort to create enjoyment in whatever you're doing in your sport and in other things. To realize that it's a choice, that nobody's forcing you to do this training or be in this sport, that it's really a choice, and create that sense of gratefulness and thankfulness that they can be athletes. And you have a choice to train hard, and then you have a choice to recover and to take it easy for a while. And just think of that pendulum that we've talked about before, that the balance of your life is like the swinging of a pendulum. The more it swings toward the right, toward peak performance, the more it needs to swing back toward the left, toward full recovery, so that you can, when you get that full recovery, then you can then swing back to the right toward another peak performance. And that you need to be able to do both back and forth and appreciate both sides of the pendulum. So, is that helpful for all of you? Does that ring a bell for any of you working with your athletes?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Nice. Yeah, great, Alex. Yeah, do I know the others of you that are on the call, Michelle and Greg and Amy? Do you have any questions or anything to share of the things that are happening?
Yeah, Dr. Joanne. One thing I was thinking of—I was looking into this a little bit. They actually call this now post-Olympic stress disorder.
Oh yeah, I love it.
I know, in some circles. And I think there are so many different aspects to the life of an Olympian, and to if they're feeling the blues after, their event is over, they may have even had a great result and they're still feeling it. And maybe if you just look at asking them questions as to, like, what aspect is causing this? Is it the, it could be just the cheer of the crowds. It could be that single-minded focus that they no longer have, or it could be, they're no longer part of a team and a unit working together. They won't have that connection with their coaches. And so, what is it that for them is the big issue, if they can identify it, and then you can, work towards a solution together once you've identified that?
Yeah, I love that. That's great, yeah, to ask them which aspect, not just are you having an emotional letdown, but what, yeah, what's the root of that, what's causing that. That's great. Yeah. And
I think they are so goal-oriented that once the dust is settled and they've done the recovery that you were talking about and they've hopefully got their head on straight again, that I think it is important for you to sit down and talk about their future, to, you know, and their goals and what it is they want to achieve. And if it's another Olympics and that seems daunting, then just break it down to, you know, the next event, preparing for the next event and work your way up slowly.
Yeah, exactly. And just find out what that next goal might be. And yeah, because I think just thinking of another Olympics 4 years later, most people think, they think, oh, so I have to train this hard for 4 years to get to the next Olympics. Just sounds, you know, the brain just can't take that in. It's just too long, too far away. Whereas...
That puts a lot of pressure on the Olympics, too.
Yeah, exactly. Training for their whole life, just for sometimes their sport only when they're performing, their sport is actually only tour a couple of, you know, only takes, you know, 5 seconds or so to perform after all that time.
Yeah.
Anything that's the most important 5 seconds in their life.
When do they get depression? Jeez.
Yeah, what if they're, you know, had to sneeze during that 5 seconds?
Yeah.
Or something else. Yeah, and I, for one instance, I worked with one athlete, Ruben Gonzalez. He was a luge athlete in the last Olympics in Vancouver, not this one, but Vancouver. And he actually became the first Olympian person ever to compete in 4 Olympic Games, each in a different decade. It's interesting. And so he was in the luge 4 times, 4 different Olympics, competing for Argentina, which is a country that doesn't have too many luchers. And so that's why he was able to do that. I think that helped. And he said after the first 2 Olympics, he really got depressed and had a letdown after the Olympics because he didn't have any other goal set. You know, afterward, what am I going to do? No, the athletes usually don't think, what am I going to do after this? After this big event. But then the next Olympics, he had lined up some speaking engagements afterward. He saw he wanted to become a professional speaker and talk about his Olympic experiences to corporations and all. And that's a really great way to kind of sort of capitalize on your Olympic experience. You know, companies love to have Olympians speak. So he had, that was his goal. He set up this one big goal after the Olympics, and then so right afterward he was, you know, on the phone to these companies and, you know, going around speaking, and so it gave him a focus, another focus afterward, and he found that he didn't have that much, as much of an emotional letdown because he had something else to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example. Yeah. If you can think about, you know, when you're helping your athlete, whether it's the Olympics or something else, helping them prepare for an event, just be able to say, you know, just ask them that question. Before their event, what are you going to do afterwards? And most athletes say, oh, I don't want to think about that. But just, you know, give them that, say, well, let's talk just for a second, you know, afterward, whether you win or whether you lose, whether you do well or not. You know, what could you do afterward to just kind of have something in place there? And that might change later, but just have an idea of how you'd like to use, use your time afterward. So, and that can help so that they know that there's something in place afterward. So, yeah, that's great. Anyone else? Is Amy still on the call or Pam or Greg?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Amy. Is that you?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, did you have any comments or anything you're doing with your athletes?
Oh, there's my dog. Yes, I have, actually. Today I'm going to do a workshop at St. Joe's University with the women's tennis team.
Wow.
And they have a really great coach who's in his 60s, and he used to play double. He was a star at UCLA, and he used to play doubles with Arthur Ashe. And he's this really great coach. coach, and so he's letting me come in and do a complimentary workshop with the team. And if he likes it and the girls, you know, think it's valuable, then he's going to put me in their program next year. So it'd be great if this goes well.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's exciting.
But then I did get a call from the coach at Penn, and she is going to put me in her program for next year. So that's really just what I wanted. So that I'm really happy about that.
The coach at where?
At University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
Yep, for the tennis team. So that's, it gives me credibility because, you know, that's a really good Ivy League school. So now, now all I have that, I got to take the ball and run.
Sorry,
their program, meaning what? In what way?
In her tennis program.
Okay, so what would you be doing?
I'm going to be doing peak performance training with them.
Great. Yeah.
I came in, I did a complimentary workshop for her and the team, and it went well. They really liked it. And then she said, let me talk to someone at school about the budget and things like that. And she said, I can get it approved for next year. So the girls will know that this is going to be a part of their training, you know, mental training will be a part of their program. So that's going to be really interesting for me.
Oh, yeah, that's exciting. Yeah. So would you be doing the next year, have you talked about the specifics? Would you be doing, like, something with them every week? Or?
Well, that's what she told me, that after they finish in April, that's when we're going to sit down and talk about the details. But she asked me to come to their first meeting in the fall, and, you know, we'll just have to plot out exactly what the program will be and how much time they can put towards it, and then we'll, you know, schedule something.
Yeah, that'll be great. Well, keep us posted with, what you'll be doing there. And it's good to know, you know, how, I mean, that's really prestigious, Amy. Yeah, University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and that's why, because there are a lot of colleges around here, but that's a really, it's like one of the top ones. And I just, you know, you just have to keep going after people.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm just curious. Is this, congratulations. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Alan.
Sure. Is this, were you able to find this to be a paid position? Or how does it work? Okay.
Yeah, she's going to put me in the budget and pay me for it.
Oh, wonderful.
But, you know, it really came from me saying I'd like to just come and do a complimentary workshop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it went well, and you know, Penn has a lot of money, and it's really whether the coach thinks it's of value. But she was she played at Penn herself, and what I'm finding is with these coaches that have a really great competitive background as well, they understand completely the importance of mental training, and so they want their athletes to have it. And they wish that they had more when they were in their prime. And so that's why this man that is, you know, having me come today really gets it. You know, he understands that it's really important. So.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And that you're, you have a strong background in tennis yourself, right, Amy? And were you a professional tennis player or top?
No, I didn't turn pro. I had a scholarship at University of Miami, so I played Division I, and then I played on a circuit, but I didn't turn pro. And then I taught for many, many years. So, you know, tennis really is my sport, but I can use these principles with any sport.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that, you've been in the college system and...
Right. And I tell the girls that when I first start talking, I tell them about my background and how I did it, and I understand, you know, the pressures that are on them, which is a lot more now than it used to be.
Yeah.
But I'm into this new thing, Joanne. I want to get your opinion. I've been doing a lot of research on different things, and the coach for today asked me if I would address the topic of grit, having grit. So I found this researcher at University of Pennsylvania, Angela Duckworth, and she has a special lab, and she's done a lot of research on grit and self-control and how the two things together make people really successful, is having the persistence, but then you have to combine that with self-control. So I found on her website, she devised a 12-question grit scale, which I'm going to do with the girls today, because uh-huh. that's what he asked for. So I think that's going to be interesting, because really, you know, in the heat of your battle, what does it come down to? It, so much of it comes down to that grit that you have. You've got to really dig in deep when things are getting challenging.
I'm sorry, what was the name of this website?
Oh, her name is Angela Duckworth, D-U-C-K-W-O-R-T-H.
I'm sorry.
And I found it because she did a really interesting video on TED, you know, online, if you look at some of those TED videos.
Yeah,
and what
TED
I'm
Radio.
Doing is I'm, yeah, the and I'm connecting it to, you know, the whole thing about the growth mindset. So I kind of connect the two things together, but it's Duckworth, and she's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. And,
so you, have you met her personally?
No, I sent her an email because I wanted to tell her about the grit scale and how appropriate it was for what I was doing. And, you know, she's so well-known. She's so busy. I can't get to her. They emailed me back and said, you know, she read it, and she's really thankful and, you know, glad that you're enjoying the research. But I asked if there was any way I could speak to her, and she said she's spending her time doing research and can't really do a phone call.
Yeah, yeah, but it's great that...
But I tried.
Yeah, yeah, good to try, and yeah, I think it's good to have these different tools and all. So, yeah, I think that's great to have.
Sorry, where did you find the questionnaire?
Oh, if you just Google her name,
yes,
Angela,
and
Duckworth.
Then a couple things will come up, and one of the things is a grit, GRIT scale.
Okay.
And I love this because I think that any coach appreciates what they want you to, you know, enhance and develop that skill of grit and persistence and, you know, trying really hard and not giving up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was so happy when I found it, because he specifically asked me if I would address the issue of grit. So when I found that, I thought, wow, this is good.
Yeah, because you could use that scale just with athletes. You could use it if you're doing a group workshop or something, have everyone take the scale and then answer. And then, have them turn it into you so you know where they're at. You could also use it individually, you know, with athletes if you're working with them. And if you're working it with a group and they all take it, then you could use it as a spin-off for discussion and all, and say, okay, good way to do it in a group would be, let's say you have 10, 20 girls or something on the tennis team, have them each take the scale, and then say, now let's pair off in twos, each person turn to your neighbor, and so have person A, and then have person A share with person B what their answers were, and then person B share with person A what their answers were, and it gives you a chance to verbalize and share their answers, and when they talk about it a little bit, it helps them to understand where they're at, and then you can have them say, okay, now so they're in pairs and they're each sharing with each other, you know, person A for a minute, and then say person B, give them a couple minutes, and then say, okay, now let's all come back together in the group. And report back. One way to do it is say, okay, person A, tell us what person B said. You know, that way they're kind of like coaches for each other too, which helps them to understand the concepts better. And so they can say, what did your partner say, or what was interesting there? Or they could share their own answers and say, what did you say about your about the grit scale, or what did you see, what were the most important points that you learned about yourself, you know? And then they could, talk and share, have each person kind of report back to the group and ask, you know, kind of why they felt this way, and what areas are they, you know, strongest on, and what areas are they weakest on, what areas do they need most improvement on, you know?
That's a good idea.
And then as individuals, and then if there's a team sport or something, you could also say, which areas are we strongest on as a team, which areas weakest as a team. And like for your Haverford College with the lacrosse, was it?
Mm-hmm.
You were doing, and say, what areas do we need to work on most as a team, that kind of thing. And then if there's different positions, you know, on a team, like somebody, they're playing soccer or, you know, lacrosse or something, maybe the forward, you know, is, you know, needs, maybe there's different kinds of, persistence and self-control that people need to be aware of. And so, yeah, you could do all kinds of things with it. So that's great.
Yeah, I think I'm going to add that today. I'm going to add pairing them up and having them do it together.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm developing a scale, you know, a different kind of scale like that, too, for different characteristics. And so it's interesting that you shared that, so I'll, which is a little different. So I'll, when I get that finished here, I'll share that with you, too, so there can be different tools that you can use. So that's really exciting, Amy. Wow, it's so cool. And it's, and congratulations, getting a paid position to be able to be at University of Penn, and maybe you can you call yourself, you know, being on the faculty or on the staff there? You could ask them what your position would be.
Yeah.
So that you could put that on your website and all, your resume.
I'm gonna try to really, you know, go as often as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, and you could yes, or maybe you're a consultant, you know, you could be a consultant, ask them what, you know, your sort of position would be there. If you can go to help them with, preparing for the tournaments, obviously, and then being able to handle, you know, let down, you know, kind of like we're talking about today, recovering, letdowns from when things, after a major event, what's going to help them recover quickly for the next period. Is there a certain season that's coming up for tennis, or is it all year round?
Well, they really make it all year because they have tournaments in between, but their main season is in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
No, in the fall, I think, the fall.
Okay.
But it's all year round because they do both.
Yeah.
It's a pretty hectic schedule.
Sorry,
yeah.
Amy, I should ask another question.
And also, Greg, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't want to leave you out. If you have any questions, let me know or want to share something.
On a little bit of a different note, I remember you had given a talk or a workshop. I think, kind of drawing a blank, about focus, and I used a questionnaire from the Pursuit of Excellence, I think.
Yes. Did you find that?
Well, did you get that from the book, or where did you get that?
Yeah, I actually have the book right in front of me. It's called In Pursuit of Excellence by Terry Orlick.
Okay.
O-R-L-I-C-K, and it's page 63.
Page 63.
And it's the focus control rating scale.
Yeah, so that's a good one to use, too. Another good tool.
Yeah, I have that for today, too. I just like to go. I feel like if I'm really prepared and I have very good tools with me, that it's going to develop and be interesting. I'd rather have a lot more information to go than, you know, certainly not enough.
Yeah,
and in the, of course, the Your Performing Edge book on in chapter 10, let's see, it's which chapter, 9 or 10, is that chapter on confidence, self-confidence. I've got a self-confidence scale in there where you rate yourself. You know, rate. You could use that also as another good tool.
Oh, a self-confidence?
Yeah.
Rating scale?
Yeah. It's a self-image assessment, I call it. But it's the chapter on, I'm just looking at the book here, it's chapter 9, which is confidence boost and self-image, which is on page 93 of the book, of Your Performing Edge book. And then the scale is on page 96, called self-image assessment. And the first thing they do is, you know, create a list of strengths and assets. So you want to, you know, you can ask them to list their all sorts of things, you know, physical attributes or accomplishments in all areas, and character strengths and question and qualities that you appreciate in yourself. And then the second task is to identify your weaknesses. You know, think of qualities that you would like to improve. And, you know, I say to take care only to use accurate, non-judgmental descriptions. So, you know, think of your sports as well as your personality. Like I lose focus halfway to the finish line or something, which is a good thing to work on, but it's not too judgmental. And then the third task is consider your negative attitudes that hinder performance. And then I give some examples there of self-condemnation and poor self-confidence and fear. And then I give examples of phrases that people say to themselves, like, I'm afraid I'm never going to get any better. And when the pressure is on, I screw up. I know I'll screw up, or I'm afraid I'll make stupid mistakes. I mean, those are all things that we all think of. And then other characteristics, negative attitudes like perfectionism. You know, I fear I won't live up to the high standards I've set for myself. I'm never content with my performance. And then things like lack of competitive spirit, or anger and blame and racing mind. So that's the third task on there. And then the fourth task is do a self evaluation rating, rate yourself 1 to 10 on these different things, like there's confidence, and then, you know, I've got different questions there. Do you have high expectations? You'll do your best in training and racing or whatever sport. Do you get excited about the idea of accepting a challenge? And then I've got self-esteem issues, you know, rate yourself 1 to 10 on those. So that might be a good
step. That would be great, too. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, page 96 there. So,
What page is this?
It's kind of embedded in the chapter, so why don't I just take it out of there? I can just, I'll put a note to myself here, self-assessment scale, and I can just take that part out and then just email it to you, email it to everyone here.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. What page was this again?
It was on chapter 96 of the Your Performing Edge book.
Page 96?
Yeah, it's a self-assessment scale, and it's for confidence and your strengths. It's a combination of things. Listing your strengths and your weaknesses and areas to work on. So it's a good overall kind of scale that I developed.
So, all right.
The Dahl Ketter assessment scale. I guess I didn't call it that, but if you print it out for people, just put by Dr. Joanne Dahl Ketter and I'll just put that on the, you know, when I email it to you there. That'd be great. So
right.
Yeah, so that's great. Greg, do you have any questions or any updates? I know you were doing a soccer camp or something.
Yeah, actually I had two workshops.
Can you speak up just a little bit? Or speak into so we can hear you a little better?
Is that a little better?
Yeah, just try to talk into your microphone or whatever it is.
I unplugged it. Is that any better?
That's a little better, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, I worked with the Fort Lewis College in Durango, California. I'm sorry, Colorado, the women's soccer team there.
Uh-huh.
And I did two different workshops. One was on goal setting and helping them determine their why, or specifically what their purpose of their team is. I used a process that I call a SWOT analysis. The acronym stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So it's similar to what you were talking about as far as determining what their strengths are as a team and then what their weaknesses are. Then the opportunities would be based on the competition, the teams they're going to play, where do they think they have their best opportunities to win those competitions? And then the threats, what are the teams that propose the biggest threats and why? So they try and break it down and then determine an action plan, if you will, to develop their training around those four things. So that was one workshop. And then
Is that your own sort of scale?
No, the SWOT analysis is actually something that's been around in business for years.
Yeah,
you can Google that, just SWOT analysis, and there's plenty of scales out there that you can, images and definitions of each. I mean, there's quite a few of those out there. So, but it parallels really well, I think, with whether it's a sports team or a business team, sales team, doesn't really matter. I mean, it's the same concept, same process. So I think they got a lot out of that. Well, I know they did, actually. And that was after. I did that one second. The first one was I call it a team rebuilding workshop. And the reason I say rebuilding is a couple of reasons. This is their spring training is obviously without incoming freshmen that will be in the new school year come September, which their season actually starts in September.
Uh-huh.
So they're going through this process. They lost 10 seniors this year or last year, and they also lost their two-time All-American. She was a junior this year. Actually, she'll be a senior this year, but for disciplinary reasons. So the team was in quite a bit of conflict. So we went through some conflict resolution type exercises and to get over this issue with losing this star player due to their, again, disciplinary issues or reasons. So that was the first day. And then the second day, like I say, once we kind of got past, okay, what can't we do? Let's determine what we can do. And then I also got to spend a day with the coaching staff, and I worked with them on their organizational skills and time management. So, yeah, it was a real productive weekend.
Yeah. Which soccer team from where? Was it what university?
No, it's a Fort Lewis College Durango, Colorado.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Beautiful place if you ever want to go somewhere that's very scenic, obviously.
Yeah, that's great. Did they pay you to do the work work with them?
They covered my expenses, yeah. So
great. Yeah, actually, and you probably could get a nice letter or testimonial from them?
Yes, and in fact, I explained to the coach what I'm doing with you, and they have had Dan Freegang give their coaching staff a workshop, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, they said, and evidently he's a well-known sports psychologist. He works with the U.S. Hockey team and the U.S. ski team, and so they were very interested in this coaching staff was very interested in the whole visualization process, mental toughness, mental discipline. So they invited me back next August 24th to work with the whole team on this process. So pretty excited about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always nice when they invite you back.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Something must have worked. Yeah,
so and make sure if you can get some kind of state, you know, a little quote from them or something to put on your website that they thought you did a really good job.
Right.
Or often if you can write something out for them and just send them an email and say, would it be okay if I, you know, if could have a quotation from you about my work with you, and then you could write something out or say, here's a couple of possibilities. You could choose one of these you like or write your own. That way it makes it easier for them.
Right. So, yeah, I've done that a few times,
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, yeah, so that's great. All right, well, good talking. We're about out of time here. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Pam, are you still there, too? Or Michelle? Anyone?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good. Would you like to just say, anyone, let's go around and just any the thing that was most helpful for you today or one takeaway, one thing that you learned that was most helpful? You guys can just jump in.
What I found helpful was what you said about when an athlete has something that's over, a big event that's over, to discuss with them in advance, you know, let's talk about putting something in place. And I think that applies to any pursuit anyone's doing. If you have something important, a big major event, and it's over, there's bound to be some kind of letdown. So I think, you know, that's a really good lesson to speak to people about. Let's talk about what are you going to put in there? You know, there's going to be a void. What are you going to plug in? Let's think about different options for you.
Yeah, great. Okay, that's good. And make a list or something of some maybe things that they would like to do. And then afterward, depending on how it goes, they could choose something. Yeah, that's great. Sure. Thanks, Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Any others of you? What was most helpful for you?
I like the concept of that you used about the pendulum, to where you, you know, if you swing to your peak performance, again, everything has to be in balance, so eventually you're going to swing the other direction, and it's just part of the process. That was powerful.
Yeah, good, the swinging, yeah. We're all swingers.
Exactly.
Yeah. How about Michelle, are you there? Anything?
Yeah, I guess for me what resonated and I found interesting was when you mentioned if your athlete doesn't get the outcome that they had hoped for, that you should try to find the advantage in that or the learning in that.
Yeah.
Good way of reframing it and turning it around.
Right, exactly.
Where is the lesson?
Yeah, there's always a lesson there, always something good comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually learn more from our failures and from our letdowns than we do from our successes.
It's true.
Great learning opportunity to dig down deep. And sometimes fourth place can be the best thing in for an athlete because it motivates, you know, in the Olympics, it motivates them to go for work even harder for next time. Whereas oftentimes, you know, I found that people who get the gold medal or something afterwards, like, especially if they did that early on in their life, they're like, after that, everything else seems like a letdown because how do I top that? Everyone's expecting to get the gold medal after that or win everything, and they just can't win like they did the first time. And it's tough. So they have a really hard time with all those expectations. So it's, sometimes it's better to be climbing up the ladder than to be falling down from the ladder.
Well, and it develops your humility, too.
Mm-hmm.
You can all use more up, right?
Right, yeah. And that we're all human and that we're have to accept the ups and the downs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. So, Alex, are you there?
Yeah, I agree with Michelle. I think sometimes the best opportunities come when we lose. And
you
take advantage of those opportunities and rather than forget about it or being caught up emotionally too much on that, on losing, rather. If I can learn from it, most likely that will be learning opportunities so I can perform better next time. So.
Yeah. And if you can.
Is that one of the reasons why you did so well in the Ironman performance? I think you remember you were doing some sports that something happened to you, and then you used that turnaround and actually used it to your advantage, and actually did very well in the Ironman. I think that's exactly what happened to you.
Yeah, I won the San Francisco Marathon, and then I got an injury after that. I had a coach that kept saying, just driving us as a team to keep going, no matter what. And I was getting injured and had a shin splint in my right leg, but he said, you know, I was actually limping out there. I remember one day, this is when I was very young and very vulnerable, and the coach said, look, you're limping. Look, we got to do these 10 miles today. Keep going. You got to finish the workout. When I'm limping, you know, the coach was just ridiculous, and I wasn't strong enough at the time. I was so young, wanted to please the coach, which many athletes do. This was back when I was 25 or so, and so I kept doing these workouts, and I ended up getting a stress fracture in my right leg and couldn't run for 6 months. And I realized, so I was completely off, and I took up swimming and bicycling just to keep from going crazy and to keep fit while I recovered. And at that time, then the triathlon was developing as a sport. And, and after 6 months, when I could get back into my running again, then I realized, oh, I could put all three of these together and do this triathlon.
That's
and I saw on TV that ABC Wide World of Sports was really, you know, featuring it at that time when Julie Moss crawled across the finish line. It was a very famous, you know, she got totally lost it, and it was down to the point of crawling across the finish line, and this woman, Kathleen McCartney, beat her at the last minute, and it was so dramatic that ABC Sports kept showing it over and over again on TV, and I said, God, I want to do that. I want to do that sport. I want to do that Ironman. After that, it was so inspiring to me, and so I ended up signing up for the next one. And sure enough, Kathleen McCartney, that was the previous winner, I ended up beating her, passing her, you know, with 2 miles to go. And she was very famous, and so all the cameras were on her. They had a helicopter on her, and they had ABC Wide World Sports had a helicopter on each of the lead women, so they had one on me. And so I knew I was catching up to Kathleen because my helicopter was really moving in on her helicopter.
That's right.
I ended up passing her, and so you know, ABC Sports caught that and told the whole story, which was really wonderful to so fortunate to have that, not only do well in the sport, but to have it, you have that video on TV. So, and that's one you probably saw, many of you, on the website there that got you into this course, because it's so inspiring.
Yeah.
So it's an example of how, when you know, something bad happens, you get injured, then if you're open to the opportunity, something really good can come out of it afterwards.
That's right.
And when one door closes, then another door opens.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, you just have to be ready for it.
So, all right, so thank you very much. I need to go.
Thank you all, and thank you very much. And our next call will be on March the 27th, that Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific. So thank you, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Dr. Joanne. Have a good day, everyone.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Okay, have a good day. Thanks. Thank you. Bye now.